blasphemy. This is madness.
Madness.
This is
Under Radio.
This is Under Radio, your fast track to the latest insights, developments, and news from Under Librem. I'm your host, Dave Robison, and it's Wednesday, March 30th, 2016. Let's get to it. What's happening at Under Librem?
Coming up on March 31st, Under Librem is proud to announce the release of the sixth novel in the Hellmaw series, The Incubus Tweets, by J. Robert King. It's a black comedy romp about Frank Demonkowski, Incubus Second Class, who gets banished to Burlington, Wisconsin after sleeping with his boss's sister. The story is told in the epistolary tradition, with the narrative unfolding through transcripts from various tweets, videos, and social media posts. You can get your copy at all fine ebook outlets and, of course, at the Under Librem website, www.underlibrem.com. Under Librem is pleased to announce development of an audio drama adaptation of Your World is Doomed, the premier novel in the Hellmaw series written by the Archmage himself, Ed Greenwood. The script is being written by Jay Smith, whose past radio theater accomplishments include Hidden Harbor Mysteries and the long-running HG World audio drama. Production starts in May 2016, and you can listen for the first episode to drop in the Under Librem audio feed in August. This won't be news to some of you, but we have a new website. This is the cornerstone upon which Under Librem will be building our community of fans, artists, writers, and gamers, and will be the portal for all our media releases, including stories, games, magazines, podcasts, audio fiction, video, and more. More? Oh yeah, believe it, baby! And for the true fan, there are memberships available that open the doors to exclusive content, members-only deals and discounts, and a host of other perks and bennies. Check it all out at www.underlibrem.com. And speaking of magazines... Coming April 13th, Under Librem is pleased to announce the launch of Under Magazine, a monthly e-zine that celebrates the creative collaboration this project is built on. Not only will it feature short fiction and art from the story worlds of Under Librem, but you'll be treated to articles and how-tos for writing, game design, art, and more. We'll be reviewing games, books, and movies, sharing a few laughs, and generally supporting the experience of being creative in the new millennium. Look for it on the Under Librem website and on digital bookshelves everywhere, April 13th, 2016. There's more, lots more, but we gotta save something for next week, right? So, coming up next.
The Story Worlds of Under Librem.
Each week on Under Radio, we'll bring you insights, conversations, and behind-the-scenes looks at the 15 story settings that comprise the speculative canon of Under Librem. This week, we're digging into the premier story setting, Hellmaw. And who better to share the details on this dark urban fantasy jewel than the Archmage himself, Ed Greenwood. Ed, I know you're crazy busy writing novels for 15 story settings, so we appreciate you taking a few minutes to speak with us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Not only do I love to sit with fellow creatives and fans and talk about storytelling and story settings, I want this whole project, this whole tag thing, this whole Under thing, to be about bringing storytellers and those who want to enjoy stories closer together. So, hey, let's talk.
All right, let's do that. Ed, Hellmaw is the inaugural story setting released by Under Librem, the first of 15, I might add. It currently has 5 novels out since its launch last October with your novel, Your World is Doomed, and the 6th is coming out in just a few days. Can you give our listeners a glimpse into the creative vision behind Hellmaw? Describe the setting to us.
Okay, we sometimes describe Hellmaw as urban fantasy. But Hellmaw stories are set all over Earth, in jungles and remote islands, icy mountains and bucolic farmland, hot deserts and the hard-biting tundra, not just in gritty cities and their sewers and back alleys, but oh yes, we visit those places too. So, Hellmaw stories are set in our real world, Earth, right now. About 2.5 to 3 years ago, Earth years, a civil war ended on another world. Not another planet, not another dimension, but another world, Arrant, the throne world of the Aurorans. The losing side in that war got exiled to Earth. So suddenly there are lots of Aurorans, daemons, among us. Now, the secret is, some humans call these creatures demons because a few of them, the misfits, the criminals, have been here for centuries, exiled here one by one. But when the Helma novels begin, in our here and now, so many demons have been shoved into our midst that we can't ignore them all, and they can't all hide. And some of them don't want to. As we warn readers in Helma, you are the food.
What was it, Ed, about a dark urban fantasy setting that made you want to develop a whole novel series around it?
Well, the Aurorans, or daemons, featured in Helma, consider humans cattle, expendable creatures, lesser beings that they can do with as they please. Most of them, frankly, want to eat us, or drink our life force, essence, as daemons call it. But some crave power, open power, so they want to rule and run amok and lord it over us. Others love to manipulate, to be the powers behind thrones, or to run criminal gangs. And some daemons even fall in love with humans. Now, they can all shape change, taking human form to hide among us, and most of them have personal powers that we might term magic. They are not superheroes, as portrayed in many comic books and movies derived from those comics, but they can take the average tough, hardened adult human pretty easily. So, they make awesome villains, and they can do terrible things. That's why we term it dark urban fantasy. But Helma is fascinating because it isn't just horror. Daemons aren't just monsters. They can be anything. They can be heroes and saviors. They can right wrongs and force humans to face their own deceptions, self-deceptions, and double standards. A Helma story can literally be any sort of story, from serial murders to meltingly tender romance to gang warfare to high-stakes political scheming. It can even be all of those things in one book. That's what's so exciting about Helma. The stories can go anywhere. They always start with a whiff of darkness and a little mystery. But after that, you never know. And in the Helma books thus far, many daemons have turned out to be really colorful characters. I want to read book after book about.
So what can readers and listeners, since all Under Librem releases will be available as audiobooks too, expect in the world of Helma? What kind of developments can they look forward to in the story arcs to come?
Okay, yes, our Helma stories are indeed divided into story arcs, and no story arc ever ends. Like all of our settings, Helma will hopefully never end, but will keep going as long as there are fans who want more of it. We want these settings to become your favorite places to visit. Imaginary places you like to hang out in, like fans of anything, anywhere. But each new arc adds things to what readers can expect beyond what previous arcs have been exploring. So the first arc, the books that are out now and the books that will be out soon, are stories in the first arc, Exile. Close-up, character-driven stories about these exiled daemons thrust into Earth and what happens, both to them finding their feet or where they fit in on Earth, and we humans finding out about these daemons among us. These demons are all here because they were on the losing side in the war back on Arrant. And Arc 2 is War Anew, meaning war breaks out again on Arrant, and many of the gates that link Arrant, Earth, and some other worlds we don't know about, but various daemons have been exploiting for years, are opened, and Auroran feuds now spill over into Earth. We become the battlefield. By Arc 3, the exiled daemons have been here long enough that there are some human daemon half-breed children, and we start to tell their stories. We have three more arcs planned out beyond that, but the problem with getting specific about things too far ahead is that what you can say can turn out to be like solemn politicians' promises written in quicksand on a stormy beach with the tide coming in. So, instead, Let me just tease a little about the Hellmaw books just ahead, just about to come out.
Perfect.
Okay, years and years ago, one of the editors of the Forgotten Realms books I was writing for TSR was Rob King. And he, a brilliant writer in his own right, has written a hilarious Hellmaw novel for us, a novel full of tweets. In fact, it's called The Incubus Tweets, and I loved it. I won't say more because Rob should and very soon will.
So, true enough.
Yeah. So after we bring you The Incubus Tweets, the sixth Hellmaw novel, we'll be hitting you with Of the Essence. A very different book from The Incubus Tweets, but I love it too. Mysterious and dark, it brings more than a few daemons to very vivid life and explores a lot of England too. It's by Gabrielle Harbawi, a very talented writer and author whom I've had the honor of working with on four anthologies now. She wrote a Pathfinder novel I really enjoyed, but because Paizo partnered with Tor Books, another publisher I've done a bunch of novels with. Oh, man, Paizo too. That's another publisher. Anyway, that book got delayed. So I think Of the Essence will be her first published novel.
Oh, wow.
I think it really captures what it feels like for daemons who live among us and are happy to live among us, or at least happy to live on Earth, and how cruel daemons can be with each other, and what happens when daemons start putting pressure on each other. It's a deliciously dark book. And after that, we're going to change gears yet again with a shorter Hellmaw novel from me. I wrote the very first Hellmaw novel, Your World is Doomed. And it begins and ends with a daemon trapped in the form of a domestic cat by the name of Throckmorton talking directly to the reader. Well, this short novel is entitled Throckmorton's Trick. And it tells, yes, Throckmorton's story. So far. I'll just say this. You will never read a murder mystery the same way again. And that's enough for me, because if I go on talking, heads will start spinning trying to remember all the stuff I haven't quite told you, because I'm trying to preserve the mystery. So let's just say that I've read the next two Hellmaw novels after that, and they're both different yet again. From each other and from what's come before, Hellmaw truly has something for everyone. And I haven't even gotten around to mentioning the short stories.
It is a multifaceted jewel. There can be no doubt about that. Thank you so much, Ed. I'm sure we'll have you back many times in the Under Radio virtual studios, so we'll keep the chair warm for you.
Hey, this has been great fun. Thanks for having me. Hellmaw is just the first of our settings, and I've been sitting on some of these story ideas and angles for so long that it feels great to finally get this all rolling and have so many talented people working on it. Ask me back whenever, because, hey, I love to talk!
We'll be showcasing all the Under Librem story worlds in future episodes and exploring some of the intriguing elements of each one with the artists and creators who are building it. Next week, it's a story setting so secret, it has a code name. But right now,
the Sessorium of Creatives.
If you haven't heard of the Sessorium of Creatives, let me clue you in. They are a collection of artists, writers, and designers who create the stories, games, and other wonders for the Ed Greenwood Group and Under Librem. They are an intriguing and diverse bunch, and it's going to be my pleasure to introduce you to them here on Under Radio. First up, we have J. Robert King, author of The Incubus Tweets, the sixth Hellmaw novel that falls from heaven and onto bookshelves in just a few days. Rob is an award-winning author of over 20 novels, including The Shadow of Reichenbach Falls and the Mad Merlin trilogy. He's also the founder of The Illiterates, a cabal of writers from across the United States, and he's a stage actor with his local community theater in Wisconsin. Rob, thanks for joining us in the sumptuous Under Radio virtual studios, sir.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. I must say this chair is very sumptuous.
You're very kind. Well, you know, we try to make everyone comfortable here at the studio, so... Rob, just real quick, give our listeners a rundown of The Incubus Tweets.
Well, basically, imagine one of the most iconic types of devils that you can imagine. A 6'6" red demon with ram's horns, big black wings, a long tail that ends in a little fleshy bulb, fawn haunches, hooves, the whole nine yards. He's dropped completely naked into Burlington, Wisconsin on a January morning at 11 degrees below zero. He has nothing with him except for his cell phone, which he immediately starts to use to try to contact his master and get him out of this predicament. Of course, he's in this predicament, and you'll find this out very early in the novel, so this is not a spoiler. He's in this predicament because, as an incubus, his job is to visit women during their dreams and cause them to have a really wonderful time. Well, one woman that he recently visited turned out not to be a woman at all, but rather a succubus. And not just any succubus, but actually the sister of the boss.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Bad luck.
So this is why Azazel, who is the main character of Incubus Tweets, is banished by his boss, Hazrahoth, because of sleeping with Hazrahoth's sister. So that's why Azazel ends up in the position that he's in. He's banished to Burlington, cannot escape until he has completed a very, very difficult mission, and I won't tell you what that is. And he's been stripped of his ability to shapeshift, which is one of the things that any of the inhabitants of Arrant use when they're on Earth so as not to be detected. So, of course, being bright red and really tall and really demonic looking, he stands out like a sore thumb against the white Wisconsin winter landscape.
So I'm gathering, Rob, that this isn't a dark, grim tale of demonic possession.
No. Well, I mean, it's using all of the same basic tropes that are part and parcel of the Hellmoth setting, but it's using them in a more comedic vein. I mean, certainly Azazel, who, by the way, has to run around town using an alias that his boss has assigned him, which is Frank Demonkowski. Certainly Azazel thinks that this whole thing is a tremendous tragedy, and that it is horrific in his experience. But for the gentle reader, it should be as much laugh-inducing as cringe-inducing.
Well, and what's intriguing to me is that the Incubus Tweets has a very different framework for delivering the story than most novels out there. You don't see a lot of authors rocking the epistolary tradition in their novels. So I'm curious, what made you choose tweets and Facebook posts and transcriptions as the vehicle for telling Frank's story?
Well, you know, I've always enjoyed writing first-person narratives. Many of my novels, including Angel Death, which is one of the more recent ones, or Death's Disciples, contain large passages that are first person. Sometimes I've written entire novels in the first person. And so it seemed to me, well, here, what's the most common way in which we write in first person in modern day Earth? And of course, that is through our social media, through Facebook posts and tweets and texts and instant messages and selfies. All of these things are versions of first-person narratives that we're spitting out all the time to those we're in contact with. And so I thought it would be really interesting to take a character who is sort of forced to use these types of media and push him into a situation where he's having to use them. So he's having to send emails to his boss, Hazrahoth, pleading for help to escape his predicament. When he's putting things on Twitter and putting things on Facebook, of course, they're also accompanied by selfies of this red horned demon in juxtaposition to all of these very sort of banal locations. So I put this story together, and of course, I think it's quite amusing. But after I had gotten it put together and gotten the whole thing designed, because I wanted it to be a very visual tale as well as being one that's told in words, I realized, okay, it's really silly to write a social media novel and not actually put it on social media. So I decided it's time for Frank Demonkowski to actually have his own Twitter account, which is at FDemonkowski, That's FDEMONKOWSKI, as well as his own Facebook account for Frank D. Minkowski. And after I set up the Facebook account, at first I had zero friends for Frank, of course, being a demon.
Yes, of course.
I approached a few folks that were in the know about this and brought them in the first ring of people. And then I approached a few more and brought them in. And then I started to just sort of friend people that we had in common, waiting to see, okay, is context going to be enough to help? Is people's ability to figure out context going to be enough for them to realize this isn't an actual demon who's contacting me on Facebook? This is something other than that. And to my delight, it has been the case that people are really good at figuring out context. In fact, I went from zero friends to about 4 weeks later, I guess it's about 5 weeks later at this point, he's now up to 1,100 friends on Facebook.
Wow. Well, it is a very compelling and effective storytelling method. Something I'd imagine the writers in our listening audience might enjoy exploring in their own stories. Can you give us some tips on writing epistolary fiction? Like, how do you decide what story elements to showcase? And what are some of the pitfalls to watch out for?
Well, you know, one of the fun things about this form, you know, this is a very old type of form. I mean, Dracula was written as a series of letters. So it's not that this is a kind of new invention. What's new about it is the vast number of different types of media that you can draw in when you're telling a story like this. There are certain things that you would post on Facebook and other things that you would post on LinkedIn and other things that you would post on Twitter. And each one of those media carries its own sort of expected conventions. And because of that, the media that you choose to tell any given part of the story needs to fit with whatever is happening in that part of the story. So sometimes I would be writing something as an email and I would think, you know, this isn't a really effective email. It really should be a text conversation between two characters.
Okay.
Or I would be working on something else and I think, you know, this is really more of a blog post. So I guess that's one thing that I would suggest is, first of all, don't force it. Let the medium partly be the message if you're going to be choosing this way of approaching a story. And then also, of course, a lot of what I was doing was exploring our current fascination with social media and all of the kind of narcissistic elements that entails, you know, that everyone wants to find out what I'm eating for lunch and so on. Of course, if you happen to be Auroran, it might be who you are eating for lunch. But that doesn't actually happen so much in this particular novel because, of course, the main character is an incubus. His way of sort of drawing the life essence out of people isn't by murdering them or by, you know, eating them alive. It's by other means. So, yes, I would say just don't force it. If you find yourself working in a medium that feels like it doesn't fit the message, then change media. The other thing is I would, as I had said earlier, trust your audience. One of the things that's really interesting to me about social media is that people are able to take just 144 characters in the middle of nothing and figure out very quickly what they refer to and how they connect to other things. People are really good at inferring context. And so that's a very powerful thing to have in your pocket when you're writing something, because it means that you don't have to have 3 pages of exposition before you get to the juicy bits. Instead, you can just leap right in, or even just post a tweet that very succinctly tells the whole scene. And the reader really just has to infer basically everything that happened that's wrapped up in that one little tweet.
Rob, I gotta ask. I've read the other Helmaugh novels, and Incubus Tweets is a radical departure, both in the canon of the story setting and in tone with the other books. I mean, Helmaugh is basically depraved, shape-shifting creatures from another world feeding on our flesh and our souls.
When you heard about the setting, was your first instinct, oh, I can make that funny?
Well, no, actually, when we were first talking about Helmaugh, and this was way back before we had a lot of the Bible documents in place, Ed was presenting kind of the broad strokes of the idea, and I thought it was a really terrific idea. And I was thinking, well, what could I write that would fit into this setting? So I decided I was going to write a short story. And it's a short story called Suicidal Savior, and it's one that's going to be offered in one of the Helmaugh platters. And it's very traditional Helmaugh. It's very much about a horrific figure who is preying upon people and drawing their life essence out of them and so on. After I finished it, and I sent it in to Ed, and I said, you know, I want you to take a look at this and just let me know, is this the kind of thing that you're thinking of? And he said he really liked it. He was very excited by it, and he would like to see more from me. Well, the problem at that point was I couldn't imagine writing long fiction in that same vein. I have written a lot of horror novels, and some are incredibly dark indeed. In fact, Angel of Death is one that my wife, when she read it, said, I can't believe I've been sleeping next to him for 25 years.
That's dark, man.
So I'm certainly capable of writing that kind of darkness, but as I myself am approaching the Grim Reaper, somehow dwelling in that kind of a mental space for 2 or 3 months at a time as you're working on a long piece, it was just more than I really could muster. And so I went to Ed and I came up with this idea of this incubus and his banishment and telling the tale through all of these forms of social media. And I pitched it to Ed and he said, it sounds great. Why don't you write up the first 10 pages or so? So I did, and as I turned it in, I said, of course you'll recognize this is more like a black comedy than like an actual horror novel. He read it and he said, I love it, want more of it. So a lot of the credit to this weird bubble in the Helmaugh universe does go to Ed in the sense that sometimes creators of worlds are very particular and say, it's my way or the highway, and really nobody else who creates anything is truly a creator. It's my world. And Ed is not that way. Ed is able to create a really big sandbox with a lot of toys in it and then invite really cool people over to play in the sandbox. And so he made room for this. And then I think when he saw it, the final product, it was still fairly surprising to him how bizarrely different Helmaugh was and other things. But he then also worked to provide a kind of backstory that would help to explain, you know, and basically the backstory comes down to you just have a hugely unreliable narrator. By the way, Azazel, or Frank D. Minkowski, in the story runs into this washed up has-been of an author who just has this kind of blasted intellect. He's no longer really capable of telling reality from fantasy. The fellow's name is J. Robert King, by the way.
You inserted yourself into your story.
Right. And Frank hates J. Robert King. He thinks the guy is just a completely worthless fellow. And partway through the story, Frank discovers that J. Robert King is writing a novel based upon Frank's experiences. And, of course, is livid about it because, you know, this guy couldn't possibly get anything right. So that's also part of the backstory, is that the unreliable narrator here, in this case, happens to be yours truly, which also can help protect the Helmaugh setting from being diluted by something that's just, you know, not canon.
That's meta wrapped in meta, Rob. That's brilliant, man. Will we be seeing more of Frank D. Minkowski in future Helmaugh novels?
Yes, I certainly hope so. One of the things that happens, I rarely write the same character. I'm not one of these writers who's able to do a Sherlock Holmes and have Sherlock Holmes be the same guy at the end of the adventure as he was at the beginning. I did write a Sherlock Holmes novel, but he's entirely transformed by it. I, in that sense, have always struggled with being able to kind of set up a series that can just play out with the same characters, because I always want what happens in the story to be transformative. So yes, I certainly hope that we'll be seeing Frank in upcoming novels, but he won't be in the same position that he was in this novel, because this novel is telling the story of his arrival and, you know, how he gets embroiled in all manner of ridiculous things here in Burlington, Wisconsin. In future tomes, he's going to have a completely different set of problems. And there will, of course, be other characters introduced as well, and the story will keep evolving. But I do think that I've kind of struck a chord with Frank. You know, probably half of his Facebook friends are from France.
Really?
I have been struggling to figure out why that is. I think that, in part, the French have a highly developed sense of the absurd. Frank is very visual. When you see pictures of him, you know, you're scrolling through your Facebook feed, and suddenly there's this red, red, super saturated red popping out at you, and this face like Groucho Marx. I think that they just immediately get it. I think that they look and say, oh, he's sort of a red mime or something. And so I think, you know, I would be foolish not to want to have Frank come along with me on future adventures, because people just seem to really like him. When I post a picture on Facebook with him, inevitably it gets multiple responses from multiple places. When I post something on Facebook that's sort of advancing the plot of his life without a picture of him, it just doesn't get as much traction. So I know that there's something is really appealing to him about, or really appealing to readers about him. So yes, I'm hoping to keep him around for a while more.
Outstanding. Rob, this has been a pleasure, sir. Thank you for making the time.
Hey, no problem. This has been wonderful. I really have enjoyed being here, and I can't match the beautiful gravelly timbre of your voice, but I think that I held my own there. And actually, you might, Dave, if you're interested, share with your listeners a previous recording of the two of us doing our best to imitate the demonic language of the folks of Auron.
I might save that for the outtake reel. The Incubus Tweets by J. Robert King hits digital bookshelves on March 31st and is available at all fine e-tail outlets and, of course, at underlibrum.com. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention you can purchase memberships at Underlibrum that include, among a veritable cornucopia of benefits, discounts on all ebooks, audio, and digital content, including Rob's book when it comes out. So check them out.
Audience participation.
This is the part of the show where you get involved. We'll cover any questions you have, share your comments and feedback on the show or the Underlibrum project, and occasionally offer up a contest. Of course, this being our premiere episode, we'll do all of that. A lot of you have been asking about how you can submit your story and game ideas to Underlibrum. First, we appreciate that. Underlibrum is built on creative collaboration and innovation. And having you step up with new ideas is like throwing gas on a fire. In a good way. But all the stories, games, and other wonders of Underlibrum are created by our internal creative community. They're called the Sessorium of Creatives, and they're a collection of artists, writers, and designers who have been invited to play in Mr. Greenwood's playground. So, how do you get your invite to the party? I'm glad you asked. Periodically, we'll be posting calls for submissions to the underlibrum.com website. It might be for short stories, a novel pitch, artwork for a graphic novel, who knows? When those calls for submissions go up, you submit. If your submission gets accepted, you're in. And don't worry, there are going to be lots of calls going out to the public. That's just how we roll. All this is up on the FAQs page on the website, but I do want to share this little detail. Under Libra members get notified about those calls for submissions before anybody else. Hey, membership has its privileges, right? Okay, now for the contest. What are we going to call ourselves? I mean, are we Underites? Libramarians? Underkin? I have no idea, but we gotta have a name for the devotees and aficionados of the Under Libram experience. And since that's you, we figured you'd give us some inspiration. So here's what you do. Go to underlibram.com and find the post for this episode of the podcast. In the comments section, type, "Here's what I think we should call ourselves." And then, of course, offer up your suggestion. Everybody who enters will get a coupon code for 10% off anything in the Under Libram Emporium. That's what we call our store on the website. We'll look over the entries and pick one that conveys the true heart and spirit of the Under Libram community. And that person will get a free 6-month Dabbler membership. Now that's a $25 value. See? Aren't you glad you tuned in?
Public calls for submission.
We're always looking to expand our ranks and our treasure vault of wonders. On this segment of the show, we showcase any public calls for submission and any open positions we currently have in the project. We don't have any public openings right now, but those of you who are Under Libra members, keep checking your inbox. Pretty soon you're going to see a couple of openings opening up there, and you'll get first dibs. Everyone else, stay tuned for our next episode. If the positions are still open, we'll announce them then. Well, that's it for this episode of Under Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it. The next episode drops in 2 weeks. Until then, this is Dave Robison reminding you to keep looking for those hidden treasures. You never know what you're going to find. This episode of Under Radio is a production of Wonder Thing Studios on behalf of the Ed Greenwood Group and Under Libram. It's copyright 2016 and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. And if you're not sure what that means, swing out to creativecommons.org and read up on the details. We'll see you in 2 weeks.